From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 26th day of January, 2021. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan O'Brien from K-State Extension. Wayne Nelson is out of the office. Don Day will be here to take a look at the weather forecast with us, and we'll talk about ASF, African swine fever, and the impact that the illicit vaccines for that hog disease is having in China and may have on the United States. And we'll do that on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn today settled at $5.32 a bushel. That was up 20¾ cents. The May at $5.33¾, 19½ higher in December. $4.44½, up 9¾. Soybeans March contract 26¾ higher at $13.70¼. And November at $11.48½, up 18¼. Bean meal $6.90 higher, and the bean oil up 97 cents for the day. Wheat futures up 16¾ cents. Settlement price there for the soft red at $6.65¼, and the hard red up 13¾ at $6.41 on the afternoon. Cattle futures were about 47 cents higher, and the hogs were up 32 for the day. Dan O'Brien of K-State Extension now joins us. You can find him, by the way, on Twitter at KSU Grains, and he manages the KSU Grains website. I don't quite recall the name of it. Grains Manager, is that correct? What's the name of that website again?
Yeah, our departmental website is agmanager.info.
Agmanager.info, that's right. So I have a question for you, because, you know, usually you and I talk about ag energies, and I don't normally ask you a lot about the commodities in general, especially in your area, but they're in Colby. You're in the far northwestern corner of Kansas, and I just took a look at the satellite view. There are a lot of crop circles out where you are. What's growing?
Well, there are. That's how we out in western Kansas try to make up for our moisture deficit to the eastern Corn Belt. You know, and we have done a good job of that for years. But water management of the, again, preservation of the Ogallala Aquifer is an ongoing concern for us out here.
Yeah, so irrigation and corn, I assume, primarily under that irrigation.
Primarily. We do see some soybeans coming in, but it's a pretty hot, high evapotranspirative environment, pretty tough for corn, and maybe except for corn, grain, sorghum. They'll grow some wheat out here, but where they have available water, they'll go for corn and sorghum probably.
All right. So you are always watching corn very closely, the other commodities as well. Last Friday was a really rough day. Monday and Tuesday, though, this week have been good days. What'd you make of the corn market today?
Well, March closed 5:33 or thereabouts, up about 21½ cents, at least as I'm looking at the numbers, and of course we're watching the new crop bids also. With impending planting decisions that'll come up, there's so many eyes focused on that planting intentions report and the stocks report coming out at the end of March. So we see 5:33 close for corn for March, and then for soybeans, up for a contract 13.71. You're at about a ratio of about 2.6 or so. Just interesting when you look at Dease corn at 4.46 and November soybeans at 11.51. And again, that soybean number fully, well, $2.10 lower than the upfront March contract. You still are maintaining just a little bit under 2.6. So slight advantage to soybeans. But frankly, when you have such high prices, and when even Kansas farmers are likely at these bids to cover full economic cost with any type of average yield, even approaching average yields, I wonder what the psyche of our farmers will be. We try to put together scenarios, and I know your good folks in the Eastern Corn Belt do as well, out of Illinois and elsewhere, to try to get some idea what the profitability will be, where acreage might go, and with this much profitability in corn, even with the acreage pull likely to soybeans, I wonder how much less corn we'd have, and I wouldn't be surprised we'd plant a good amount more soybeans. We plant about the same or somewhat better for corn too, and then start pulling from everything else. out in our part of the world, we generally pulls from for non-irrigated crops, pulls from wheat into corn. We might, out in our area, given the tremendous grain sorghum basis that we've seen this year. When I say tremendous, that's like $1.25, $1.30 over the March contract. New crop grain sorghum basically take a dollar off the upfront bid, so it's 25 to 40 cents, or has been of late. So for us on dry land, we call it dry land. You guys would call it non-irrigated. For us, it's really dry land out here in the Western Corn Belt. Grain sorghum with that price, if that expectation becomes reality, that really does affect the relative profitability of between those two feed grain crops. And so if there's anything that maybe pulls the corn number down, it might not come from your part of the world. It could come from our part of the world where we have the grain sorghum option, and we see a jump up in sorghum acres, probably at the expense of corn.
So I have a quick question. Generally speaking, we have about 180 million acres of corn and soybeans combined across the United States, 90 apiece, and it varies from one year to next what that mix looks like. Do you think it will be a larger number this year?
Well, if it was just pulling from wheat, I would wonder. It's a Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas thing where if grain sorghum acres move higher, and well, last year we had 5.8, 5.9 million acres of grain sorghum planted. And if we're up 10%, you're talking 58 million. If you're up 20%, it'd be
580,000,
Let's say you end up with 100,000 more grain sorghum acres. I guess in the broader scheme of things, that doesn't make a big difference, but it does. If grain sorghum does jump up here in the Western Corn Belt, it would mainly come at the expense of non-irrigated corn. So and some low margin wells where grain sorghum would come in as a lesser water thing. So
will those be replacing wheat acres that are torn up? And in that case, I would think it would go to sorghum because it's dry, right?
Right. Dry with the hope that something would come along. Of course, it's quite the conundrum. If you have an opportunity for wheat, it takes a lot of courage to tear up $5.50 per bushel wheat to go
yes,
for.
Yes, it does.
To go for.
Well, I was just thinking if it's dry and doesn't have winter and it doesn't have snow cover to keep it from winter kill, that might be a problem. But
yeah.
I just don't know enough about production there.
Well, here's the deal. In Garden City, Kansas, heart of the Southwest Kansas livestock feeding and ethanol sector, wheat prices on Friday were $5.85 a bushel. Grain sorghum was $6.25 per bushel. So you've got that. We are seeing out here in the Western Fringe even some feeding of wheat in livestock rations to compensate for the high-priced corn. Now, that's not all over the place. It's probably more you hear of that occurring very southwest Kansas, down in the Oklahoma Panhandle, on into parts of Texas. But again, corn, valued commodity, hard to get hold of, that if wheat is just more plentiful and available, even at a relatively, at no slouch of a price, still wheat's available. So we're starting to see some wheat, and the USDA in that last supply demand balance sheet, they did take the wheat feeding number. I think there's an acknowledgement of that. They raised the wheat feeding number up 25 million bushels for the U.S. overall. So really thought-provoking.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care, Todd.
You too. That's Dan O'Brien. He's with K-State Extension. On this Tuesday, Don Day joins us from Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Good afternoon to you, Don. Thank you for being with us. I want to explore the winter weather in the western part of the United States and then talk a little bit about some other things. But maybe start with this big storm that we've been moving through recently.
Yeah, certainly a big storm for some of the northwestern areas of the Corn Belt. A lot of areas, more than a foot of snow across parts of eastern Nebraska, many parts of Iowa, then moving into portions of the Great Lakes. It's all of a sudden here in the last couple of weeks. Winter has decided to really get started after what had been a very mild winter so far. But there's more winter weather to come as we take a look at the last days of January and into early February.
Tell me about it, please.
Well, we're going to see the system currently moving out of the Midwest and Corn Belt over here the next day or so. There's going to be some snow across New England and the Great Lakes. Another system is going to leave the High Plains and come through the area this weekend, producing another event of snow. Not as big, but keeping it very wintry. We have a parade of systems coming off the Pacific and going across the U.S. And that's one thing, Todd. Now, speaking of the Western United States, for most of the winter, all the way up until here recently, we really haven't seen a lot of Pacific storms hit the West Coast then traverse the country. That's why the winter started off so mild. But things are changing. And while it's not great for some folks to be digging out of a lot of snow, this pattern is bringing some needed precipitation to the western states.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about that and maybe put it into context of some of the wheat growing regions from Texas all the way through Montana and snowpack and what that means eventually, because when that melts, it feeds the irrigation systems in part of the western United States as well.
Although precipitation in those areas you just mentioned has picked up, we're still way behind. You know, some of those wheat areas from those areas you mentioned, Texas, up areas to the north, have had a drier than normal winter. And the weather systems that have come in, while producing some snow, hasn't been the amounts that would really lead to good soil moisture. So we're going to be concerned going through the rest of the winter and spring in those wheat areas with a soil moisture deficit. When it comes to snowpack, a lot of the snowpacks in the northern and central Rockies are about 70 to 80% of normal. Only the far northwestern United States have snowpacks that are at or above average. You look at the central and southern Rockies, some of the Great Basin, some of the central snowpack areas of the Sierra Nevada, they're all only about 60 or 70% of normal. Now, snowpacks are going to be getting a boost here in the coming weeks, but they have to play catch-up now for the rest of the season.
Is it something that you talk about regularly where you are?
Oh, absolutely. And an overriding feature, and we've talked about this in other discussions, Todd, is that it's a very significant La Nina, and what we're seeing in the central and western areas of the United States with the below average precipitation this winter is textbook La Nina, and it's something that is likely going to carry forward here at least for a little bit longer. We're somewhat hopeful that maybe February into early March will be a little more moist, but you really got to look at those late March and April and May storms to really where you catch up with the moisture the quickest.
And snowpack is really a concern about water supply systems.
Absolutely. You know, reservoir storage conditions in the western United States were doing very well going into early 2020. But as we went into the second half of 2020, a lot of the central and western United States turned a lot drier. So if we go into the spring and summer dry again, that's certainly going to really knock down a lot of the reservoir levels across the western and central United States.
Don, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
That's Don Day. He's with Day Weather from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Well, the Chinese government has been working for more than 3 years to contain an outbreak of ASF in its hog herd. The Chinese raise more pigs than all the rest of the world combined. ASF is a devastating disease that kills all of the infected animals. And producers in China initially tried to contain its spread through early detection, culling the population, and biosecurity. The government stepped in to create vaccines. However, as has been reported elsewhere, there are non-governmental vaccines too. And these have created a long-term problem for hog production in China and maybe for the United States. University of Illinois veterinarian Jim Lowe is an infectious disease specialist that works with the hog industry around the planet. In this conversation, Lowe explains ASF, the issues China is now having with it, and how those make it easier for the disease to spread.
Yeah, Todd, and thanks for calling today. ASF, right, is a high fever virus of pigs. We know it's happened all over the globe, particularly in Eastern Europe and then in China several years ago. And we know very little about this virus. It's the largest virus we know about. And in spite of the fact that it's huge and easy to see relatively on the virus scale, we know very, very little about it. So normally ASF causes a really high fever in pigs. It's a very acute disease with high mortality. So most of the pigs that are infected die. They don't die right away, but they die. And the virus tends to reside in meat and muscle and blood for long periods of time. So even after the pig dies from the disease, the carcass is infectious. And that's really our big concern. So the Chinese have been able to detect ASF quite rapidly clinically. So animal has high fever, they go in and find that animal and they remove it. And they remove the animals around it. And they've been able to really over the last several years kind of perfect, and that's a loose term, perfect a control strategy that's allowed their swine herd to rebound. The world's largest swine producer, world's largest swine consumer, pork consumer, they've allowed that herd to rebound back to somewhat normal levels. Well, somewhere along here, we had a couple of genes within the ASF virus that they think are responsible for virulence and in the immunogenicity or how they produce the immune response. And so some vaccines have been produced in China, which are illegal or illicit. They've not been sanctioned by the government, that are called knockouts. So they did some fancy gene jockeying, the magic of gene jockey. They knocked out these genes, and then they put them in pigs as a vaccine. So it's an attenuated live vaccine. And what happened was one, it doesn't induce very good immunity, it appears. And number two, it's not nearly as virulent, but it's still virulent. So it spreads slower, doesn't produce as high a fever. And so it's basically blown up the entire control strategy they created. It's just not made it very effective. They relied on a high fever to identify a sick pig. Now those pigs don't have that. So the disease, these lower virulence vaccines, and I would put that in quotes if we were next to each other, those are quotes, right? The vaccine that was produced, and it's illegal vaccine, the government's been very clear about that, are spreading quite rapidly within the herds, which really changed the clinical picture of what's happening in China.
What does that mean?
Well, I think it means a couple of things. One, the Chinese are not likely to get the virus under control very quickly, which is, you know, we'd anticipated that it would be a long slug for them to get it under control. But they've done quite a good job of returning pork production to somewhat normal levels in China. So that's we thought that was good. That was going to mean that they could feed their people. They continue to import pork from the U.S., but just as importantly, they continue to import grain to feed their pigs. World demand, right? Big pork producer, big need for grain. World global demand would be there. I think what it says is with these viruses circulating, and certainly anecdotally, it sounds like there's the Reuters story, and then there's a lot of other rumors, and I think that's what they are, is rumors, but you know, they're probably somewhat reliable. You know, these viruses are spreading quite widely and not inflicting the serious damages we had at the beginning of the ASF outbreak in China, but certainly inducing losses in these herds, which will, we believe, have a longer term effect on dampening the rebound of Chinese production. And probably mean that they're not going to have the pork supply that they've wanted to have over, you know, really given their projections, what they thought they were going to have.
And so then we come down to, does the United States garner that extra supply, meaning we export pork there rather than grain, because we were going to feed hogs, or at least that's what the intention has been, both with soybean meal and corn. Can that be maintained?
Well, that's why I'm not an ag economist, Todd. That's why we had to talk to Gary. I'm just a veterinarian. I don't think we know that. I think that's a really good question. And I don't think probably anybody knows that right now. The question becomes, what's going to happen to their long-term meat demand? Will their desire for pork shift over the long term? Will it settle at some lower baseline? We don't know that. And I think historically, we've always assumed that the Chinese are huge consumers of pork. They would return to their per capita consumption. And if you have a sustained disruption in supply or a sustained increase in price, what does that do to demand over the long haul? And I don't know that. I don't know that answer, but I think those are the kind of questions we as an industry are certainly going to have to ask.
Does this new ASF version present a different issue for U.S. pork producers?
Yeah, I think the thing we can be very confident in, this has probably changed our risk profile for the U.S. Drastically. This virus is harder to detect because it's not as clinical. So it is more likely to be out there in an undetected state. And when we think about biosecurity or disease prevention, not knowing where the virus is our biggest problem. And we've seen that in human disease with this pandemic, with COVID, that, right, the virus moves around. We've got this new variant. Oh, where is it popping up at? We don't know. And then we start playing whack-a-mole. And that's actually what happens in animal disease all the time. So that's not a political comment or anything else. That's the real challenge of infectious disease management, is knowing where is it at. And diseases that are very aggressive clinically produce a high morbidity and mortality rate, particularly a high mortality rate, or at least a high disease rate, are terrible, but we know where they are and they're easy to detect. When we don't have a high mortality rate, the inapparently infected, we get a lot of transmission we don't know about. And in the case of the U.S., where we're free of African swine fever, that transmission in unknown areas becomes a huge risk because we don't know where to put our barricades up to keep ourselves from getting infected. If we go back to with COVID, right, we know that the inapparently infected people, those that are infected that don't have clinical signs, shed or infect a lot of people because, right, they're not tested, they're not sick, they go around and they infect other people. Well, when we think about ASF, if I've got an attenuated virus that was a vaccine and is now outspreading and not causing a lot of disease, I won't know where that virus is. And so our risk of getting infected here in the U.S., I think, has gone up significantly with this, you know, emergence and transmission of these new vaccines. And I'll put that in quotes.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
No problem, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Jim Lowe specializes in infectious diseases of hogs and is a veterinarian in the College of Veterinary Medicine here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report for this Tuesday afternoon. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.